I'm Stanley Laham. I have a PhD in immunology from the Department of Immunology and Molecular Genetics of the University of Florida from 1978. I am presently retired. My doctoral dissertation was the discovery of a new retrovirus, meaning a virus carrying reverse transcriptase, the same family as HIV viruses.
Now, we first spoke to you back in 2020, Stanley, in the spring and summer of that year about what was rapidly developing pandemic, someone called plandemic. But the point being here that there was an enormous reaction around the world to this SARS-CoV-2 virus. We've now got. We've learned, I think, quite a lot in this time. We had a lot of investigation into the origin, a kind of contest really between the idea that this is was a naturally occurring virus coming from bats or pangolins or something, and others saying, well, no, this is a lab leak. And it certainly looks as if the lab leak hypothesis is winning with, particularly Jeffrey Sachs, who was in charge of the investigation and was working for The Lancet, coming out recently and saying he believes it was a he was lied to by the people who are supposed to be investigating, and it looks increasingly like some kind of covert military program. But anyway, that all that aside, I'd just like to ask you a bit about your take on the lessons that we've learned over the last couple of years.
Well, now that you've spoken about Jeffrey Sachs, today, and this is why it's a very propitious day that you've decided to ask me about it, there's a study that came out in iScience by Dr. Maya Weinberg. She led a team of scientists in Israel. They went through every paper that was published since the SARS-CoV-2 virus was identified as a human pathogen and then an epidemic and then a pandemic. Her conclusion is that there is absolutely no proof that this virus came out from the bat population. It's been published in Cell Biology in their iScience, I for I suppose internet, iScience publication. So this today, and it's only today that I read the paper, it reinforces what Dr. Sachs had said, and previous virologists, who have said that some of the furile connections between genes, to find a popular way of saying it, could not have evolved naturally and had to be genetically engineered. So there's more and more reinforcement that this virus came from a laboratory, most probably through what is called, quote, gain of function experiments, meaning genetic engineering, to adapt it to particular cells, to give it receptors for particular cells in the laboratory, which made it become very pathogenic for humans. I don't think now there is much of a doubt about that. The person who was in charge, the should I say the COVID-19 czar of the United States, which made it automatically, since the United States is the empire, the COVID czar of the Western world was Dr. Anthony Fauci, who was very much implicated in the Wuhan lab experiments, who could not really defend the hypothesis that it came from, you know, those raw markets where supposedly bats were sold. So this is not something to discard, you know. It's a very, very real possibility. It's a probability. And no one is being held accountable.
Yeah, well, that's pretty shocking. I think we feel the same, many of us here in the UK, that you know, it's almost as if events have moved on and you know, there are other things to focus on. The implications of the lab leak, deliberate or otherwise, are that this is a human created pathogen. Now, you know, whoever created that human pathogen, whoever paid for, authorized it to be created, surely they should be either, I mean, you know, this is the side of this, which is, you know, many, many thousands of people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives.
Yes. And let me tell you what I learned from Dr. Maya Weinberg's study. I discovered a virus myself, of the family Retroviridae, of the subfamily Spumaviridae. And the way I knew that it was from feral raccoons is that I took their tissues, grew it, and the virus popped out of their tissues. In other words, I isolated the virus from the organs, various organs, of that animal. It seems that they've never actually isolated the virus from the organs of the bats. They have decided that it came from those bats because the bats had antibodies to the virus. And they did PCR, RT-PCR tests that showed that they recovered RNA, viral RNA, from the bats, and declared them the reservoir for the virus. But that actually whole viruses were not isolated from the bats. I didn't know that. She went through all the literature. I had assumed that they had isolated the virus from bats. But they have not. It's mostly viral RNA and serological antibodies in the bats to the SARS-CoV-2 virus that made them decide that the bats were the reservoir of that virus. And she challenges that conclusion. And we have Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, who says that undoubtedly after 2 years of research, it came from the laboratory. And I think from the beginning, there was a big cover-up. I have no doubt that Dr. Fauci was aware of that. And we went through 2 years. And this is the first, perhaps, scandal, the origin of that pandemic. The second chapter in this story is now how Big Pharma profited from that with their new mRNA vaccine. And I think this is a story we've covered. This is something that, as you know, since 2020, before the mRNA viruses came out, that I said I enumerated the dangers of an mRNA virus, of an mRNA vaccine. And we are seeing now some, you know, pulmonary consequences from the vaccines and cardiac consequences that are now being directly linked to these vaccines. in their Emergency Authorization Act that Big Pharma was given, these vaccines were not properly tested. They will be at the experimental stage until the year 2024. For you to have a good perspective on that, the poliovirus vaccines that were developed in the 50s were tested for 7 years before they were approved for human use. Whereas these went into production and used, this was Emergency Authorization Act, and used the same year that they were developed. It's unconscionable. But billions, hundreds of billions of dollars have been made from that. So we have two chapters, two parts of the story. One, the origin of the virus. Two, the exploitation of the pandemic.
Well, I mean, one might even suggest that, it might be worthwhile financially to release a virus that, Big Pharma can make a lot of money out of. I mean, that could, there could be a financial incentive to do that. But I'm talking to you from Gloucestershire in England, which is just down the road from us, just by the River Severn, down the Cotswold Escarpment, is the little town of Barkley, and the little museum there to a chap called Edward Jenner around about 1800. He introduced the world's first vaccine, which was for smallpox, quite well known. It was a similar disease, which was cowpox, where he realized that by actually deliberately giving people cowpox, that actually gave them their bodies, it trained their bodies in such a way as that they were much less likely to die from smallpox. So this is quite a successful, amazing a bit of experimentation, and they, it's said that he has helped eradicate smallpox from the planet as a really dangerous disease nowadays, and save millions of lives as a result. I wonder, Stanley, whether you think Edward Jenner would look at the vaccines that have been produced for COVID, these new mRNA type and the AstraZeneca type. If you could say a little bit about maybe, what these vaccines are, how they're different to ordinary vaccines, if they are, whether he would recognize them actually as vaccines at all.
Well, I doubt that Edward Jenner would even be, the advances like isolating the messenger RNA for a particular structure of a virus, which is the spike protein receptor of the virus, he would have been lost in that. But he certainly would not have called it a vaccine, because he called his procedure vaccination because it came from cow, from the Latin for cow. So obviously he would not call that a vaccine. But he would be totally lost. It's for example, imagine Sir Isaac Newton seeing rockets going to the moon, spaceships going to the moon, using sometimes or going out even of the solar system using what they call gravitational slingshot effect, even though he's the one who invented those things.
Let me rephrase it then. What about you? What do you think, it's a vaccine as Edward Jenner originally envisaged this idea? I mean, because one of the basic things is surely, I mean, what Jenner did is he used something that was naturally occurring. These are man-made.
Correct. And the way he deduced that is because he noticed that milkmaids were not getting smallpox. And if they got it, they got it very mildly. And in an epidemic where people were dying of smallpox, milkmaids were immune to it because of their contacts with cows and cowpox. So he correctly deduced that their exposure to cowpox made them resistant to smallpox. And this was an incredibly good deduction worth of, you know, a good scientific deduction. And thereby he used the scrapings from cowpox to inoculate humans, and it worked. And it became the first vaccine. The mRNA that we're using now that they're calling a vaccine is a totally different idea. You're not being exposed at all to the virus. They're isolating a piece of messenger RNA from that virus that codes for one of the structures on the surface of the virus. They took that mRNA, surrounded it with nanolipid particles held together with antifreeze, ethylene glycol, and injected it into the population. Now, what I had warned about is that this mRNA, once you inject it and it gets into the bloodstream, would not remain local. Cells of the muscle cells where it's injected would take, pick it up, reverse, translate it into the viral protein, where it would go to the surface, migrate to the cell membrane, and your immune system would recognize that viral spike protein, make antibodies to it, and this would immunize you against the coronavirus. And I said, since then, the problem was going to be it would not remain locally. Many other cells in your body, from cardiac cells to pulmonary cells, and hepatic cells, liver cells, may take it up, do the same as what the muscle cells locally do, and then create autoimmune attacks on these organs. And now there is no doubt, even though they don't say it directly, they say, well, yeah, there is an association between vaccination, between the mRNA vaccines and the wave of pericarditis and myocarditis that we've seen. But they don't say the crucial link. The only way that it can do that is if the muscle cells of your heart picked up that mRNA and started producing the viral antigen, which caused an attack by your immune system and inflammation of the heart, inflammation of the pericardium. That's the only explanation.
That doesn't sound good. It sounds to me as if the vaccine could potentially be injuring more than it's curing people. In other words, you know, this famous phrase that the cure is worse than the disease.
Very possibly. We're already seeing the start of that, and time is going to tell. You know, there are so many examples where Big Pharma knew that they were putting out something where the cure is worse than the disease, but they figured they would make billions and then get sued and pay off later. Isn't it amazing that we're asked to trust whatever Pfizer tells us, when Pfizer, a couple of years ago, had the biggest payout in pharmaceutical history, $2.1 billion for damages caused by one of its products. But they had already made their profits. And if they can sustain such lawsuits and still be profitable, that gives you an idea of the astronomical amount of money that these people are making. And what they call the health industry in general, I think, has surpassed in trillions of dollars the oil industry. So we have to come back to our original, you know, discussion, first you have the doubtful origin of the virus, which is, it looks like we had been deceived. And two, you have this taking advantage of the pandemic. Let me give you a concrete example of this. In 2020, Dr. Fauci recommended remdesivir as an antiviral that would make the disease much less lethal. Now, remdesivir, when he did that, many virologists knew that back in 2004, remdesivir did not work well against SARS-CoV-1. So we knew that much. And yet he recommended it for SARS-CoV-2. Gilead Pharmaceutical, that produced it, made a fortune just in time because the remdesivir patent was expiring in 2023. Their stocks went up by $16 billion. Their major shareholders, some of the executives, sold for over $100 million, just like Moderna, of their shares and pocketed their money. So, and now we have the World Health Organization declaring that no, remdesivir is now not indicated, it's contraindicated for COVID-19, and it may even cause some renal failure. And the conclusion is that remdesivir, after being used for 2 years intensively at an astronomical cost of $12,000 a pop, did not work and may cause renal failure. Yet no one has held anybody responsible for that. Dr. Fauci has taking his golden retirement, and he's not being held at all accountable. Just that is past history now.
Yeah, so I mean, decisions like this, you know, you do wonder. It seems like the finance, the gold in the scales, is rather higher than the science.
Definitely. And for the people, this is very important, Tony. They keep saying, calling people who question the veracity of what they say, who question the methodology of the vaccine, who question the safety of the vaccine, they brand them anti-science. When in reality, they're the one denying the science. They're the one putting profit ahead of science. And then we've seen something extraordinary. We've seen, and I'm sure they're the one who finance it, a bunch of quacks who come out from I don't know where saying, well, there is no such thing as a COVID virus, as a coronavirus. There is no such thing as a monkeypox virus, this and that. This is something you sent me and you asked me for my opinion. And I told you, well, this lady is a total quack. And I wouldn't be surprised if these things are promoted by Big Pharma in order to discredit the real scientists who are questioning their methodology.
So a disinformation campaign, almost like a psychological warfare campaign.
Precisely. In other words, if you have a bunch of quacks putting out, you know, absurdities. And that's why when you sent me this, I sent you my contribution in, which was a copy, you know, a link to my doctoral dissertation, that viruses, you know, do exist. And there is such a thing as, monkeypox, which was discovered in the late 50s. And there is such a thing as coronaviruses, which were discovered in the mid 1960s.
Mm.
But when they have these people, and let's face it, I am amazed by how gullible the general population is.
Mm.
You have complete, like I said, like you said, psychological warfare. They send these people out with ridiculous arguments, almost theater of the absurd arguments against what Big Pharma is doing in order to classify those who have valid scientific objections to what they're doing. And they put them all in the same bag. Look at all these quacks.
So one of the things that's characterized the various interviews we've had, Stanley, with you, is being that you have focused quite a lot on treatment, not necessarily on trying to uncover what was the actual origin. And as many doctors would do, you're saying, well, actually, what we really need is we need to know how to treat this well. New York doctor whose his father was an Orthodox Jewish rabbi, actually, I found out recently, Dr. Zelenko, he came up with something called the Zelenko Protocol quite early on in all of this. He believed pretty, I mean, he did quite a good job, I think, in predicting this right near the start of all of this, saying, well, actually, what they really want is this is to make money out of a vaccine. And he was prescribing drugs like hydroxychloroquine and saying, well, look, really, if what you need is these cheap drugs very early on. And so what do you make? He's died sadly recently, but he was the doctor to President Trump, and Trump was roundly ridiculed for using hydroxychloroquine, so what do you make of these various treatments? Because it does seem to have been quite an effort to ridicule things which were very cheap but could have saved potentially millions of lives.
Well, there's no doubt that a combination of zinc, vitamin D, hydroxychloroquine did give, protection and shortened the duration of the, of the viral course, of the pathogenicity of the virus. But these things were not only ridiculed, but they made it sound like, people were selling snake oil. And unfortunately, with their approved drug, if you remember, for 2 years, the only approved drug was remdesivir. When people spoke of ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine with vitamin C, vitamin D, and zinc, and of course, an antibiotic to prevent, like azithromycin, to prevent secondary bacterial infection, and if necessary, a steroid in order to prevent the cytokine storm that the virus caused, the over immune reaction that was causing coagulation in the alveoli of the lungs. And most people who went through that treatment, no matter how bad the strain of the virus was, whether it was the Delta strain, they went through it successfully and developed good natural antibody against it. Whereas we're seeing now, people who were vaccinated twice, boosted twice, still catching, new strains of the coronavirus. And no one has asked the question, well, you know, the coronavirus, like the poliovirus, is a single-strand positive RNA virus. One of the main differences between them is that the poliovirus is non-enveloped, whereas the coronavirus is an enveloped virus, which makes it a lot more susceptible to washing, to soap and water, than the poliovirus, which does not have this lipid envelope, lipoprotein envelope. The vaccines that were developed for poliovirus, whether it's the live Sabin vaccine or the dead Salk vaccine, created immunity that literally eradicated polio. And nobody asked, well, how come variants didn't spring up? Whereas with these mRNA vaccines, variants are springing up constantly. Well, the answer is very simple. These whole virus vaccines, the attenuated Sabin or the killed Salk vaccine, elicited multiple immune responses, multiple antibody formation towards many different structures of the virus. Whereas the mRNA that was injected, that can cause damage to many other organs, elicited one specific antibody to one specific protein of the coronavirus. So a very limited mutation could render that antibody that you're producing non-reactive. Whereas in order to have variants that were resistant to these other original vaccines of polio, you would have to have multiple mutations of multiple sites to render the original vaccine ineffective. Whereas with the mRNA vaccines, simple mutations. And as a matter of fact, the vaccine would select for these variants to pop up.
Look, Stanley, the obvious question after that is, if you imagine there's two people, and maybe any listeners who, you know, listening to this now can think of two people, one who's had the series of the mRNA COVID vaccines, that is to say, you know, Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and someone who hasn't but has had COVID, you seem to be suggesting that actually it's better to have trained your immune system, your own natural immune system, to build up antibodies than it is to have had these various vaccines. I wonder, is there any evidence that somebody who's caught the disease naturally without having a vaccine may be better prepared for another similar virus in the future?
Let me tell you, as far as the coronavirus, as the COVID-19 virus is concerned, there are worse studies that show that people who are naturally infected have much better immunity than people who receive the mRNA vaccine parts 1 and 2 and boosters to boot. There is no doubt. You know, this is what Descartes would call an indubitandum. These people, of course, you are much better prepared if you had. I'll give you a simple example. My granddaughter, on her first day in school last year, 4 years old, became COVID positive. She went through a week of being moderately sick until no more RNA, viral RNA, could be detected. I had her antibodies. She had a very strong antibody titer. She has excellent memory cells. And now I don't fear for her for, you know, any of the variants that may appear. And if they would say that school children going into first grade from preschool, now that those vaccines are ready, should they make it, you know, mandatory? I would say no. My granddaughter is not getting it because she has had, and I can document that she had COVID and that she made a strong antibody response to it. And she has memory B cells to deal with anything else.
Well, what about adults and what about elderly people, though, Stanley? I mean, the argument is that the series of the vaccines and the boosters, we're getting up to something like five now in continental Europe. I think it's only four here in the UK, that those people are less likely to be hospitalized.
I'm not going to comment on that because I don't have the statistics in hand. But I'm sure in the years to come, we'll have those statistics in hand. The reason those statistics are not that readily available is the same reason why when the Association of Professional Caregivers demanded through the Freedom of Information Act, they demanded from the FDA all of the documents that made them license the Pfizer vaccine for human use. The FDA only agreed to release them over a period of 75 years, which is unbelievable, incredible. And yet we don't see anyone protesting that. Until the people demand an explanation, then, you know, there will not be an explanation given.
I mean, I know you know quite a lot about this autoimmune disease or the autoimmune diseases, and you suggested quite early on that one of the dangers of these mRNA vaccines is that they may produce autoimmune diseases later in life. They may linger around in the body. But the specific question I'd like to ask you is about people with autoimmune diseases. Do you think that they may they should be saying, well, hang on a minute, I've got an autoimmune disease. Is this mRNA vaccine, is this going to be actually appropriate for me?
Yeah, I think they should ask the question. I think people with lupus, with myasthenia gravis, should ask that question. Personally, I can tell you personally, if I suffered from lupus or myasthenia gravis, I would certainly not take an mRNA vaccine that's going to make me produce more antigens that my body is going to recognize as foreign. I already have a problem that my body is recognizing part of itself as foreign and attacking it. I would certainly not add an mRNA to my body that's going to make more cells in my body produce an antigen that's going to be recognized as foreign by my immune system.
I mean the subsequent question to that, of course, has got to be, and what about people who've got maybe autoimmune diseases in the family, like MS, for example?
You know, Tony, I'm not going to extrapolate on what I said, because then I can be accused of extrapolating without the science.
No, fair enough. But I mean, I think these are important questions, and I don't think people are asking those questions. The doctors don't seem to be asking the questions. And one of the things we seem to have lost in all of this is this whole idea of informed consent, where people are told exactly what the risks are before any kind of treatment takes place. And their doctor is being incentivized financially to do, I mean, actually, it's not even necessarily doctors. In some cases, here in the UK, it's several hundred pounds goes to a care home manager who has successfully got all of the care home residents the booster jab that's just coming along here in the UK. And these aren't even clinicians making these decisions. It seems that there's a strong financial impetus on people to do these things. You know, doctors given... Now, hang on a minute, because a doctor is paid a normal salary to do a diagnosis. A doctor is not shouldn't surely be paid in order to say yes, use this vaccine. I mean, because the money is already going to the vaccine company to pay for it, and what we're saying is that actually the doctor that prescribes it should get a little bonus on their salary. So it seems to me that the these clinical decisions of informed consent are being elbowed out by these financial incentives.
Well, you obviously said it. All I can tell you, I can add here that in 2020 and 2021, hospitals were getting a bonus of $39,000 for each patient they put on a respirator. Do you remember that?
I didn't know that, no.
No, of course you knew that. You must have known it. You're forgetting it, but this was well known that hospitals were getting a bonus, supposedly, because they have to use the respirator, and this was a bonus for when there was a lack of respirators. Remember the crisis? We don't have enough respirators, and they were being built, in an emergency way to equip hospitals with as many respirators as possible. There was a big respirator story that was going on, that they didn't have enough, and hospitals were being given a bonus by the government for patients that were on respirators. This is something we've covered before.
Do you think those respirators were necessary?
It depends. If instead of giving them, like I told you, the virus would cause a cytokine storm, which would cause multiple small emboli in the lungs, which the better treatment would have been steroids, not a respirator.
What about these mRNA vaccines again? Going back to those, Stanley, I hope you don't mind me cross-examining you almost on some of this. But, you know, I've heard that actually they were originally developed to fight cancer. And I wonder whether you think that this is part of, another program where they've said, well, hang on a minute, we could use this thing we've developed for cancer for something different. Do you know much about that? Because it would seem a bit peculiar to use something that was developed for one thing for something else, particularly when it doesn't appear to have been that effective. It may have made a lot of money for the pharmaceutical industry, but it may have been a lot cheaper to use simple drugs to treat people for COVID rather than to try and get them dependent on a program of vaccines.
I'm not really an oncologist, so I'm not going to comment on that. All I can tell you is that for cancer treatment, we've gone from chemotherapy to targeted therapy, to immunotherapy, and some of them have been very successful in the battle against cancer. The use of targeted therapy that targets certain enzymes that only the cancer cells use, this is what is called targeted therapy. Immunotherapy, also where you do antibodies that specifically attack segments, or should I say constituents of these cancer cells to inhibit their growth, have been quite successful. But I'm not going to you know, I'm not going to comment on that. All I can tell you is that in the fight against cancer, there has been quite a bit of progress.
Okay, so just looking at the pandemic generally over the last couple of years, how would you characterize it, maybe in comparison to previous pandemics like the Spanish flu?
Well, as far as I can tell, the main the big difference is that first of all, the lethality of the virus, the mortality and morbidity of this coronavirus was not comparable to the Spanish flu, and then there wasn't this incentive to make billions of dollars off of the Spanish flu pandemic. Nor was there an incentive throughout. This is a new phenomenon. You know. For-profit health is a new phenomenon that's making a lot of new products come into the market, which are not well tested, but will make many millions, if not billions, for pharmaceutical companies. So I think this pandemic has been a lesson in manipulated disinformation, manipulated scientific results. Remember the famous paper that came out that showed that chloroquine was a great danger to your heart, which turned out to be a fake, which had to be recalled. The scientific paper, the scientific journals that published it recalled, and we've talked about all of these things. So I think this pandemic shows to what degree the profit motive can corrupt the science. I think that's the main lesson of this pandemic.
I mean, have we ever seen anything like this before?
Well, not that I know of, perhaps. Certainly not in my scientific lifetime.
Okay, Stanley, can you just let us know whereabouts to we can follow your work online if people want to follow you? I know you do quite a lot on ResearchGate, which is an important resource out there for people who want to, to do scientific research in a kind of public bulletin board forum kind of fashion. How do we follow your work?
Yeah, well, you can. Your listeners can look up my profile on ResearchGate and some of the discussions. As a matter of fact, the discussion that I started, the thread that I started on COVID-19, which started with the question, why has chloroquine not been recommended, which I started back in 2020, is one of the longest and perhaps most read thread on ResearchGate. So, and people can see links to my papers and doctoral dissertation, because though my doctoral dissertation dates from 1978, 30 years later I received the letter from back in 2010 from the University of Florida asking me permission to put it online, which I gave them. So it's accessible online because they wanted to show the kind of research scholarship that came out of the University of Florida.
Looking at what we've experienced over the last couple of years, what are the lessons? What are the main lessons?
I think the main lesson is we shouldn't have health for profit. It's a very simple lesson. This causes encourages corruption even in the scientific community. The health should not be for profit. I think that's the main lesson. And this pandemic, we knew that from before because of the way the health system, remember the movie that Moore had done called Sicko, which showed how corrupt the health system, how the from the pharmaceutical companies to the big hospital companies to the insurance companies. It's a triad of corruption because of the profit motive. As long as we have this profit motive, you're going to see unhealthy healthcare.
And maybe even more for-profit pandemics.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Okay, Stanley Lehame, thanks very much for joining us once more.
You're welcome, Tony.